Hello and welcome to The Shape of Work, a podcast series by SpringWorks. My name is Anoop and I am your host. Each week, we'll be talking to top people managers across the world on the future of work and how it's shaping our workplace. So sit back and get ready to find out more from these movers and shakers as we have a no-holds-barred, anything-goes conversation with them about their journey, their insights, their thoughts, and most importantly, their ideas and vision for the workplace of the future. Join in on the conversation, leave a comment, and don't forget to hit that subscribe button.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shape of Work podcast. Today, in this episode, we have Swaroop Hegde, CEO and co-founder of BlockVigil and Powerloom. He's a developer slash entrepreneur since his teenage and has extensive tech experience in this blockchain space. And he's a very cool person in real. So yeah, welcome to this episode, Swaroop.
First of all, thanks for the opportunity, Althea, and happy to be here. Some ways I'm already connected to SpringWorks, being an advisor to the company in the past. My name is Swaroop. I'm one of the co-founders of actually two companies, BlockVigil and Powerloom. I'm used to saying usually only one. Both are in the blockchain space. One is more of a developer tool and now focused on infrastructure. We started out with building that developer tool, and then we've been powering the infrastructure for a very popular network called Polygon. We were like literally the only ones when we started. And Powerloom is one of newer companies. I think it was formed exactly like a year ago. We started working on the idea. We haven't quite launched any products yet. We built a few prototypes. We've been mostly focusing on solving problems in the DeFi space when it comes to transparency and leveraging data, both for like power users and like, you know, consumers. So we've been working hard on building a protocol to solve that. In general, I've been an entrepreneur for about 20 years now. This is all I've done. I have mostly been doing startups. I grew up in India. I technically studied engineering, but I have been building companies prior to that. I'm very passionate about building web products. I think it caught my attention a very long time ago. And I used to get very fascinated with building, like the first time I built like some basic things on the internet. And, you know, I've never gotten bored of it. Web3 is more of a newer thing, I would say, maybe about 4 years of full-time into it. But prior to that, I've done esports. One of my companies was acquired in the space. I think at that time, it was early for the time. And now it's a very popular space. But you have done, I've done multiple sort of industries, e-commerce, social, even built like this very popular Twitter service around 13, 14 years ago when Twitter itself was in mainstream. I think internet is a great medium. So I feel you can build all kinds of different products. And so I think I must have started out more on the consumer-y side, and I have now shifted my focus a bit on the B2B and B2D, if you want to call it, developers as it is.
I just noticed that you have like 6-7 ventures, right? So when do you decide?
Launched ventures. I think there were many more. I think on LinkedIn or AngelList, I list the ones that I at least launched in public that people used. Now, not necessarily people paid for, so which is why I say not all of them were successful. So been, you know, like you actually ideate on so many different things. And not all of them sort of see the light of the day.
So when do you decide to have that as a, you know, when you, thought of working on an idea, when do you decide, okay, this has to be a company or this has to be a product in that, you know? So you have like Powerloom and BlockVigil, right? So when do you think, okay, I have to separate it out and this becomes two different companies? So,
So I'll get to the BlockVigil and Powerloom side at the end. In general, it's usually about solving a certain problem, right? Which is, I like to call it an itch. Like something I have to be very passionate about solving, because I think otherwise I would definitely not make it into a company. I would probably do it as a side project, but I would not make it into a company. Now, for something to become a company, which I think it's very easy to say if I incorporate the company and, like, you know, these days, AngelList launched something yesterday, but I've been telling people that with Stripe Atlas and all, you can just like have your company set up in a day these days.
Yeah.
There's very little bit of effort involved. But truly companies are built when you have either customers or you have a lot of users, right? So why I say users is they may not be paying you, but they're creating enough value for the company for it to, whether it's valuation or whether it's creating certain value, right? There's a lot of consumer startups that don't make money right away. So it's very difficult to differentiate that. So I generally say it becomes a company when you actually have customers. But as an entrepreneur, I think it's more of the commitment, right? I think what you're specifically looking for is how do you take a side project or something and turn it into something else, right? So I still remember, even before Blockvisual, I was working on a few ideas in the Spring Roll office while I'm helping Spring Roll with some things. I think I built something with healthcare, which I think I was very passionate about, and I truly want to solve, and I've been helping others to solve that. But there's certain things you just don't have the either the domain expertise, right? Yeah. So you could take a risk and you could find the people and solve it with them, or you take a bit of a backseat and figure out a better way to solve it. Like sometimes you're solving a problem and you sort of find a better way to solve, which may not be your original idea, and that's completely okay, right? Now, a lot of times it's very difficult to make that decision because you don't know what's right or wrong, right? Only time will tell whether that idea works out. And I remember for Blockvisual, I was actually doing something else. I was building a bot, and a lot of people in the office were using it. And then as I was building it, I realized how difficult it was for, as a developer with so much experience, to be building something for Web3. And I think much hasn't changed in 4 years. It's definitely a lot better now. But that's where it hit me as an aha moment. Like, wow, this could be something much bigger than the idea I'm already working on, right? So I had to sort of ditch that and sort of take this as my larger idea. And sometimes it's a bit of a gut feeling. You have to be a bit stubborn, right? Like you're taking a risk and you don't know if it's going to work out. So people like to say if you get funded, it becomes a company. I don't know if that's true, but it is a validation though. Because if people are willing to give you money in whatever way as investors or customers, you know, there's something there, right? It may not necessarily become a successful company, but that's where the starting point is. If that sort of answers your question.
100%, yeah.
Awesome.
So, one of the issue with all this blockchain as well as, you know, when you say decentralization, etc. So how do you make revenue, right? So it's a difficult thing, right? All these companies try to be very decentralized and so how do you make revenue as a company? So how do you solve a problem which basically generate revenue?
There are newer business models with decentralization, which are harder for people to understand because it's new, right? So whenever something is new and you're not used to it, not much has been done. People don't know how to behave and they don't know how to react to it. I think that's the right term. So now I'll give you a very simple example of Blockvisual. We actually make pure SaaS revenue, right? Like we get paid by Stripe, or like maybe some of the customers do pay us with like what we call our stable coins, which we can liquidate into US dollars. So it's not a big deal. But, you know, we designed it from day one to be a SaaS company. And, you know, we hit a 2 million ARR from last September to like, I think it was somewhere around July of this year.
Yeah.
We hit the goal from like zero. There was almost nothing. We didn't even have a team. We didn't have any funding. We had run out of money much just around the pandemic. I remember before the pandemic got big, we had, and that's when I was raising. So interestingly, we found a business model that works, right? And it didn't matter, even though we were targeting Web3 customers who themselves were doing other things, we were making money the traditional way. And there are exchanges, there are many companies doing different things, right? Now, in the pure Web3 sense, and I'll give you an example of Paulum, but even though I feel like we're very, very early, so it's not the right thing, but I'll just tell you what our proposed business model is, right? So we are building an economic economics around a token that incentivizes people to take advantage of the protocol. Now, that is so much more different from like explaining SaaS. So you can imagine when I myself have to explain both of my companies, which are very different business models, right? And they're in the same space, solving similar problems. One is focused on some, you know, different target audience, but it has a completely different, not just a business model, which is, I think, what we're discussing, but even your go-to-market approach is very different, right? With LockVigil, how we make money is so much straightforward, right? Like, we didn't even have a sales team yet, so it's been word of mouth, but people come, they buy. It's like a very simple sort of a SaaS, self-serve SaaS, yeah. But we could easily put a sales team on it or whatever, right? Like, but we use the word of mouth to sort of get the revenue forward. With Paolo, the goal is that, you know, we'll have these early adopters who will be helping us with various things. I don't want to go into the details and specifics of it, but they are incentivized to take part in the network. And then because they took the early risk, they get rewarded the most. But then what they also do is they set the standard for what the future participants are going to be doing, right? And everyone is incentivized. So it's almost like, you don't really have a company, and it's more of like we are proposing, let's say, a decentralized autonomous organization, or a DAO is what we like to call it, right? To let the decisions also be made that way, and the community votes with a certain token and all those things. But, you know, apart from that, even if there was not a DAO, you're incentivized for doing certain actions, which is how our world generally is supposed to work. But because we have monopolies and we have regulation and things, we try to fix things, right? But when you look at complete free market, that is what decentralization actually tries to go. Because there's no centralized authority telling you this is how it's supposed to function. And I think it takes a little bit of to wrap around your head. You have to sort of spend a bit more time to understand. But I don't think every person in the world needs to jump in and be part of that, right? So I think there can be, like, my focus has been for the last 4 years building these what I call bridges, so that these Web 2.0 users should be able to use these decentralized technologies without changing their habits, right? You can't expect them to set up wallets and all these things to go and do that. So there are it's like a slider between convenience and decentralization, right? Like the security and the thing. So I think there's a lot to it, but I think a lot has also been changing. More and more people are interested. So I'll be very curious what happens in the next, let's say, 12 months.
Sure. So this one of the questions that I have is, you know, when you start as a new company, right? LockVigil and Powerloom, you're starting a new. How do you set up the culture? How do you do the hiring? Like, it's a new field, right? So you're doing something which is not being done by someone else. So it's hard to find people who relate to your mission and all that. So how do you do the first hires, and how do you set up a culture even before starting, you know, your company? So
I think culture is very industry independent. I have this culture channel on LockVigil from day one, like January 1st, 2018 is when I set up that Slack. I called my now co-founder just to come help me out. And I told him from day one. And you know, that's something that I used to spend a lot of time with Karthik too, from SpringRoll, seeing how he had done a good job of building the, and it's even better now, right? Like, it's 4 years down the line. And from the very beginning, he was very particular about it, right? Whether it was Glassdoor reviews and all those things. But how do you sort of, as you scale, there are challenges that you face, right? But what you're bringing up is even harder, because it's the initial part. You have no one, right? How do you sort of get people excited? So the way I think is, much of the culture is set by the co-founders until you have the, I don't like to think of tiers like management roles and all those things, but just until you have the founding team in place, right? And then that founding team ends up hiring more and more people, and then that's how it goes. But it's always top down, right? It's, if founders don't set the right culture, it's very difficult for others to come and try and attempt to have a better culture, because at the top, the person is not doing a good job. So I think that's very key. And it doesn't matter, right? Whatever industry you're working in, it's super, super important. As a matter of fact, I always say that, you know, I hate the word, the title CEO when you're a small company. But something I've learned as an experience is, and, you know, it's a very common thing. People write about it a lot. There's only three roles for a CEO, actually. So one is keeping the lights on, whether it's through customer money or through funds. You're making sure that the business has enough money so it doesn't run out of business. The two is basically setting, you know, hiring the right people, right? That culture that you're setting, that is super, super important. That's like two, three things that you're just going to be focused on. Because everything else is like you're doing strategy and most things. You're not really supposed to be coding or you're like, of course, I code and I enjoy doing that. But that's like inherently the main job, right? And I think as founders, that's one thing that we have worked hard and it's not been easier. Actually, I feel with Paoloom, it got even harder, even though we had access to money. Like we realized that itself isn't enough to hire people, right? How do you excite people when there's so many, the demand is so high, especially in the remote world, and you must be aware of it, right? And even though we are in Bangalore right now, where we have access to better, you know, large talent pool, it's not been easy, right? How do you get excited about a problem? And there are enough people who want to come work for you, but finding that difference between, you know, who are really passionate about your vision, and sometimes you cannot sell that vision on an interview call. So you almost have to set a little bit of what I like to call some groundwork, right? Whether it's through articles, whether it's through some presentations that you've been doing consistently, right? Then people can go back. And that's why when I set up that channel, and we have done that again for Paolo, is that if someone joins, so like we didn't have the first hire for Blockvisual until 14 or 15 months. Oh. So when he came in the 15th month, he could see all the way back to the beginning, and I never deleted anything. As a matter of fact, I paid for Slack just so he could search the historical thing and see the very first message. Even if they were not great decisions, there was a thought process, right? Why are we thinking that way? And then, so they can connect much better and they can understand. And sure, no, not everyone's going to go through the historical context, but it's very, very important. It's like building an entire timeline to set your culture. So that's, if you set that, then hiring becomes easy. At least retaining, I think it's even harder. People misunderstand that aspect a lot because they just want to get a lot of people on board. I think specifically you asked about how do you get people excited about Web3 and all these things. Fortunately, others are doing the job for us these days. They're getting people excited about Web3. I think 2018-19, it was rough. I think a lot of my own close friends used to diss, you know, like it still is the running joke of blockchain and all those things. And it's been very difficult to find that niche, but I think I have maintained my stance on certain things. I've definitely worked on a few things in life in general, but certain things I've maintained my stance. When people see that you don't budge away, right, just because someone's saying something else, and you consistently sort of persevere and you deliver, people sort of appreciate that a lot. And then, and that is only time, right? And it's very difficult because how do you invest that much amount of time? Beyond that, I think if you do a solid job of explaining what you do, and depends on who the person is, if they are an engineer or if they are non-tech, then you just have to sell them on a much grander vision. And I think vision is, if you don't have the vision from the beginning, it's very difficult. You'll iterate a lot, right? But I think it's a very, you know, you'll read a lot of books and podcasts. Even I listen to a lot of them. But nothing matters at the end. there's no magic solution. That's what I'm trying to say, right? Everybody has their own way.
Got it. So, so one more question that I have, obviously, maybe not really with the theme, but when do you think, when you are solving a problem, right, it's in the idea phase, when do you decide, okay, this is, how much time do you spend from the idea to actual launching the product?
Yeah, this is a tough one.
Yeah. So you have to basically decide the target group and also the, you know, all these things.
The problem we have, and I think it's both a good and a bad thing as entrepreneurs, is we're not doing a lot of things like a big company, right? The ones who are going to do a lot of research, a lot of meetings. We are just like iterating, especially if we are tech heavy founders, because we are going in straight away building. And that's what I enjoy more. It's my style. It may not work for everyone. I generally recommend people to do research as well, because you may not have the liberty or the energy. Like, I'm totally okay if I have to drop everything if I realize 3 to 4 weeks down the line that this is not working. But most people are not, right? They feel very scared. They don't have a backup plan and they feel the burnout and all those things. And over the years, they feel more and more, right? I will say that over time, I have been trying to do things much faster, right? It's not the fail fast kind of analogy that I want to throw here because I think that's also now overhyped. In terms of, let's say, like I have this magic 6 to 8 week thing from idea to building that first MVP or a prototype. If we are able to do that, which is very difficult, right? Most times, if you're a big team, that's even harder. If you're a smaller team, you're sort of doing that. So I think during the pandemic, last year, during the lockdowns, I've shipped like 2 or 3 of those products with those cycles in mind. It's like a hackathon methodology, right? You're very quickly coming up with something and then you're shipping and you're letting the ship product do the talking rather than another mindset, which is more of you're doing a lot of market research, finding out what the market, what's needed, and then building towards it, which is also great because then you're really shipping something that people want and you haven't spent that time building and you've actually spent more time doing their homework. So everybody has their own style. I'm more of a builder. I think I like to build more. But I think with Powerloom, we have done that in the beginning and then we have done less of that. We have actually spent more time ideating, researching, because we actually, what I did was I was able to buy more time by raising capital. And that's something I didn't have the luxury before. So it's like a, you know, what your circumstances are, you can decide on it. I feel it also depends on the person, right? Everybody has their own financial time and all these sort of currencies is what I like to call it. And it's not just always money, right? Because you might have dependency with your family. Maybe you've quit your job. So there's so many things that play factors. And what if you're in a regulated space, right? If you're building something in the regulated space, it actually takes a really long time. There's a guy who's building a fintech product out of my WeWork space. And I think most people would have given up. But amount of time it has taken for them to like finally get to that product. And we still don't know, right? Like it has to, we know it's like, I'm confident that it'll find product market fit, but we still don't even know. So they're going to launch that and then they'll see if all their people who are excited about the product are still excited and they're going to use it. And that's going to generate revenue in some particular way, or maybe it'll get investor attention. So we still don't know, right? He's been spending 2 years and I met some hardware entrepreneurs who spend 2-3 years, right, just building that prototype. So it's so hard, right? It's very difficult, and I think everything has a different answer. I fortunately feel with software and certain things, you know, it's so much easier. Especially even in the, like, I'll give you an example of the block, which is product that actually generates that revenue. I literally built the first prototype from a Friday morning to like a Sunday evening. Like that's how quickly. Like I had Thursday, I think I remember we closed the customer before we had even thought about the product. They committed to, and I'll never forget, they're still a paying customer. So that's, I'm very happy that a year later they are continued to be with us. So my goal was how do we get to 1K MRR? So, and they committed to that. They even paid, like I went on Stripe and I quickly collected the payment and then we started building the product and then we launched one version and we realized so after the prototype, the first version, we gave it to them, but then for the public launch we knew it was not going to scale, so we had to build another version for that, right? And of course we have iterated over time, but that's how quickly, right? And within a month we had gone to market not knowing how good this was going to be. So sometimes, you know, it can be a very quick thing as well. So it's a, you have to trust your instinct, but at the same time, I think I have the benefit of experience, but I also have the bane of age and certain things which play against me, right? Because if you're younger, you're in college, I think you can take a lot more risk because you have nothing to lose, right? Worst case, you'll just go back to doing something else. So I think, I don't know if that specifically answers your question, but it's a lot. It's a very difficult one to answer. But it's a very important one for people to keep in mind, whatever they're trying to build.
Got it. So right, you have a tech background, right? So it's maybe you can build a company, you know, you and just your co-founder and all that. So do you think non-tech founders have a future in the blockchain industry? You know, not just blockchain, the whole, you know, NFT and the Web3 industry. How do you think their approach may be different to that of a tech founder? Any thoughts on
that? I think it's even coming from a tech founder, it's a bit of a misnomer that only tech founders can build it. As a matter of fact, the best companies are mostly built by some business person, right? Because they understand, they have business sense. Engineers don't. I have spent a lot of time putting that business sense into my head to get to where I am today. And it's still work in progress, right? I don't call myself as a perfect business person. And I know that I could have benefited a lot more if I had a pure business founder, right? I think once in my life, I had one person, maybe in 2017 or something. Unfortunately, there were some other things that didn't work out. But I could see that it's like complementing skill sets, right? So it's important. And it's had nothing to do with Web3 or things like that. I completely disagree that Web3 is something that requires more tech skill. It might require more understanding of these new concepts. But in the end, smart folks, they'll figure out how to hire the right people, right? So the one thing is, if you're a non-tech founder and you have this idea and you've understood, so you still have to do the homework, right? You have to identify the need. And that doesn't take tech skills unless you're building a very technical, like we are building a protocol. Of course, it requires tech-heavy founders, right? But it's still, when it comes to the community building and all, I know that I have to hire non-tech people because they're the ones who are going to go and make it bigger for me, right? But if you're a non-tech founder, one thing I would say is, if you're building a tech company, right, a tech-enabled or a tech company, you should focus on finding a strong technical co-founder. It's when you go for these like outsourced and like part-time folks, it's very difficult for them to continue with your vision. So if you can't even sell your vision to one person, that's what I always say, right? How will you sell it to the world? So it's very, very important that you do that. And you don't undervalue that tech founder. Like, it happens a lot where the business founder feels, oh, my idea is worth a lot more. No, hell no, right? Try to make them an equal founder, because then they have equal skin in the game. But that's not necessarily always the case, because it really depends on a lot of factors. If you're putting in the money, you're taking the initial hit, then you're probably taking more risks. So you deserve more equity and all those things aside. But I think Web3, NFTs, trust me, I know so many non-tech founders doing so many crazy things right now. You just have to meet the right people, right? Yeah. If you're building a tech-enabled company. So that becomes crucial, because you want to build a company with somebody you vibe with, because you know, otherwise, how you're going to... It's like, I mean, I'm not married, but that's what I always think is closest to. It's like having that strong relationship for a very, very long time. And you cannot just break apart, because the company will go away. That's it, right? If there's any issue with one of them put together.
Sure. So one more question. Obviously, NFTs are the trend, right? So what do you think about, you know, it's going, the tech is very, you know, it's very interesting and all that, but it's going a different path. Do you think it's going a different path? Like, it's all digital art, you are creating monkeys, all this apes, CryptoPunks, all, everything is happening, but it's maybe NFT has few other utilities, right? You would have read the thread also. That has been posted, right? It can have a lot of utilities. So do you think this is a good way to go? Like the direction that NFTs are going into, the more of an art sort of thing and not into like solving, you know, these actual problems that are coming up. So any thoughts on that?
So for most things to succeed, you actually do need a little bit of hype. This understanding, I think I got much later in my life, because I would diss it too, right? I'm also bothered by this, not this wave, the first wave of NFTs that happened earlier this year. And because I've been following this space since 2017, I've met so many people who have been doing different things. And I remember like explaining the concept of ownership. It was nothing to even do with NFTs. NFTs is just a standard, right? But the concept of ownership, what it does, and that is something I'm constantly fascinated with right now. Of course, what's happened right now is everybody is just aping into it to find a way to get richer and do that. Now, I'll put my sort of a personal opinion aside on what I sort of think, but in general, for a space to succeed, sometimes you sort of need that bit of hype cycle, because what it does is it brings a lot of attention and money, that people then finally find out what works. So you need that and you can't help it, right? And even if I disagree or you disagree or a bunch of people disagree, it's going to happen anyway, right? Now, in terms of solving problems, I think that's a very, it's a very perspective thing because like I told you what I had done before Web3. So that was more in the esports, but you know, I spent a lot of time understanding the same economics in gaming with virtual skins and stuff. So it's nothing different, right?
Yeah.
So the fascinating part is you're taking that, but it's a little more in your control rather than a virtual skin, which is, you know, sitting on a centralized system like Steam, which I still use. Like I used to, I don't play much Dota anymore, but I have a lot of skins sitting there. They have no value, right? They're just bragging rights. And that's what, if you have that understanding and if you think about collectibles, that's what NFTs are, then that's fine. Of course, there's too much going on right now for people to differentiate. But you know, when I've tried explaining NFTs, this was about 3 or 4 years ago, and I think it still stands. I tried explaining the concept of ownership to people. And I gave an example of something extremely rare, which you cannot even own. So let's say the painting of the Mona Lisa, right?
Yeah.
Now, you can never own it. First of all, it should always belong in a museum. So it will. And beyond that, you know, like the whole concept of why would, what would you want to own, right? So you want to own some bragging rights. So let's assume an extremely rich person in the Middle East or somewhere has access to millions of dollars, right? And the Louvre Museum decides to mint an NFT, which is basically for not ownership, but for, it's basically just a concept, right? So it's the digital version of the Mona Lisa. And you get to own that and you still don't get the painting, right? But you get the bragging rights, right?
Yeah.
Imagine how much is that worth for someone, right? Super rich. Now, the good thing is they don't have to worry about the painting stuff and all those things. And they can always, and it'll always be displayed next to the painting, let's say in a hologram or something like that, that, hey, this is the person that owns it. And if it gets transferred, then that is also, you can verify. And that's the beauty of using that. Now, you could tell that this could easily be done with, that's what Christie's and all have been doing, you know, for auctions. But the best part is it enables anyone to do that, right? You don't need permission. You don't need someone to whitelist you and like certain things that way. But I know for sure that they will not let just let anyone have it, right? So there'll be like certain things around it. But what if it was a 1 year bragging right? Then it suddenly becomes very interesting, right? So I think that's where I remember explaining the very first time, like, what is NFT even mean in this regard, because everyone's like, oh, I'll just copy paste it. But it's not about copy pasting, it's about the bragging right, right? So if you are a collector, you truly understand what it really means, right? So but yeah, with the artwork and all right now, there's a lot of confusion going on, but I will tell you that it still has enabled so many creators to showcase their talent that they could have never been able to do that, right? So I think that's the difference it does. Once the hype cycle dies down, you'll still see what it has created, right? So you sort of need these things as well. But I'll tell you what personally what I like. If you could gamify, which I think there's a lot of these gamified NFTs going on right now, and I think CryptoKitties was also one of those first ones, because from the gaming concept, that's what I think can really make it fun. And then it really becomes, you know, the rarity. There's a game of chance. There's so many things that can make it so unique. It's like certain skins in, like, I was talking about Dota earlier, right? So certain skins in Dota are not for sale anymore. You cannot buy them. They're limited edition.
Yeah.
And some of them, people are not willing to trade. So the value is so high, even though it's really bad, right? It was created 5 or 6 years ago. So it looks like crap compared to the newer skins, but people are willing to pay more because they know it's rare. So, and I think that's what it is at the moment. And imagine if that was opened up for everyone to do it, then the Steam marketplace would be filled with nonsense as well. So that's why they have that quality control from Valve, right?
So how do you, so one question in this, how do you do the quality control when it comes to NFTs? You know, it's all blockchain, you say immutable.
Really shouldn't, right? If you truly believe in decentralization, you let the community decide what is good quality, right? Let people vote. Is this a good enough thing? And by the way, this does happen on... So that's why I keep telling people, go to the Web 2.0 version of it to understand, right? Second Life, all these things have existed. I used to play this... I've really forgotten the older games and all, which all had these concepts, right? So we're just, all we're doing is we're opening it up. And the fact that if something shuts down, you don't lose everything, right? That's the beauty of NFTs. They still, they will exist on the public blockchain, at least hopefully. The ledger, the network doesn't shut down. And so if you were to take that, that as an example, like specifically, can you repeat that part? I'm trying to think of
how do you regulate, content,
so the quality, right? So quality would be very similar to like, just like how I mentioned about a DAO. So one example I was thinking of, it just came to my mind. So, just like Steam has a thing called, Greenlight, for projects, for games and many things where they let people choose, right? So they let people vote with their wallet or with their whatever thing. So each time you vote up and down, depending on that, things get prioritized and shortlisted, which is similar to what's going to happen. And that already happens right now, right? So you can fill the world with spam. Like that's how our world also works, right? You go to a comment section on YouTube. Do you see all the comments? No. I like to sometimes see. I like to see most recent comments just to not get, not let algorithms decide what's good for me, right? But then you have voting and all those things, right? That's why. So voting is one thing, but that'll always be the case. And it'll always be very difficult, right? There's no way to filter out everything.
Got it. I think I have talked. I finished. I do have a lot of questions, but just one more question. How do you think having a sort of a decentralized identity on a blockchain? What's the, you have sort of a wallet address, right? And you are sending all this money to different wallet address. And if you, change, let's say any, a digit or something, and it's going to something else, right? So how do you, even in UPI, if you see, you check the name of the number, right? To check. So it's not happening really in the crypto world right now. So how do you think it's, ENS domain?
It's already happening. On Ethereum, it's called Ethereum name service. You can map it to a name. So if you go to swaroopetch.eth and you put that on Etherscan or on MetaMask, it'll point to my address, which becomes a lot easier, right? You don't have to worry about it. And then what I've done is I've done a reverse mapping so that it's a, if you put my address, it also returns that. And then you can go and see on Twitter and you can cross verify and all those things. What you're asking for is like a, just a repository of names and things. Like with UPI, I'll give you an example, right? Yeah. It happens actually quite often that you can miswrite someone's UPI, like especially with numbers and things like that, right? So it does happen. You can't do anything about it. But what you're talking about is because addresses are harder. So this is like a mapping to it. And so ENS already exists. And of course, there are other services that do email to address mapping. I think on centralized systems, you can even send crypto to an email and then they will connect it to their wallet. Of course, then it's not really a decentralized address anymore, but it does the job, right? It's like having PayPal where you're really not worried about a bank account and they will credit it to your wallet. Let's say you want to hide where the money is going to and they will collect it from your side and then they will credit it to you, whatever your address is. So do check out the ENS domains. They're really, really useful. Definitely on the Ethereum chain, it is difficult currently right now because the registration cost is only $5.
But
the gas fee is higher. So they've been working on setting up on Polygon and others where you can essentially have like a subdomain of it maybe so that, because see, in the end, the reason like people don't understand gas and all these things is because they're not putting effort into understanding how these systems work, right? So because there is demand, that's why it's high, right? So if it was cheap, then it would not be as, like there would, the value wouldn't be there. And which is why, but as soon as, like I'll give an example of Polygon, right? So when we were first making transactions on Polygon, they're probably 100 or 10,000 times cheaper, I think, because the Matic price is also cheap. So if I multiply that, the Kuwait price has gone up and Matic price has gone up. So it's probably about 10. It's still cheaper compared to Ethereum, right? But for proper incentives to work, it has to still map out, right? It can't always be cheap. And same with ETH, right? It'll eventually get there. But like I already have a bunch of domains that I think we have the company ETH, one, and I actually tend to not use my ENS a lot, but it's one easy way to tell people that, hey, you know, this is my identity on the thing. I actually built something called OneKYC using Stripe's identity thing, so like similar to like Spring Verify before Spring Verify was born. So I had access to this in 2019, I think. And I remember showing it to Karthik at that time, because so the goal was like I could verify against an email and then like have even a KYC done, so that, you know, because in a more real world scenario, you'll need that as well. But you could still have a partial centralized and partial decentralized. So centralized verification, but proofs would exist on chain. And eventually we ended up building a movement pass thing called Adapta. I think the demo is not online, but if you go to the website, it's there. And we built this during the first lockdown in India, so that people could submit forms, and then there would be an, instead of worrying about addresses to verify your thing, you would get a nice QR code, and you could still verify on chain, right? So, and you'd not have to do your KYC over and over, because you could connect that via email to a centralized server. Or nowadays, there are more ways now to solve that, where you don't even need a centralized party to connect to a wallet thing. So I think Taurus and others are there to solve this problem as well. So there's a lot of people who have a lot of problems that have been solved. But I think I do agree that still not very, very mainstream, because, you know, we are so used to Google sign in and all these things. So it's difficult for people to wrap their heads around like having too much control. I think people want convenience, if you really think about it, right? We don't like to control everything. Right. Yeah. Like I'm probably a bit of a power user. I like to have control of most of the keys and like even like passwords and all ours, you know, like a one password thing, which is not synced with a service. So I have a completely custom way of handling it. But people are happy, right, to give Google the password. And if once you get in, then you're sort of giving away most of your things, but you're trusting, right? So there will always be that, like a middle ground for most people.
I think we are about time. So just one last question. What next for blockchain/Web3? I use them interchangeably. So what next for blockchain and Web3?
I think it's still like very, very early. There's a lot happening. You'll hear a lot of the DeFi buzz. I'm also very much interested in once we sort of go past that as well, and then we start using it in so many different use cases. Like I actually have worked on a lot of different use cases. There were some things that were definitely not possible due to the scalability issues, which have now been solved, right? So what was storage has also been solved with Filecoin and others. And you know, like I'm very bullish on what people end up building. And you know, people are skipping a lot of this, like countries will skip centralized systems and move straight to decentralized systems. So when that happens, the standards, like the acceptable standards, will change, right? Like right now, when I'm in Bangalore, I expect that most of the places I go, I don't need to carry my wallet with cash. I can just pay with UPI, right? That has become the standard. Can you imagine that years ago? But as I was taking that train journey, I was telling you earlier before we started this, as soon as I left Bangalore, like I had to start using cash at most places. I mean, I could use it once I had reached a certain destination, but within the place where there was no. So it's that expectation that will reach at a certain point. And I think that's where it will go more and more mainstream. So we're just getting started. There's so much that's going to happen. And there's so much that has happened in 12 months. I haven't even been able to keep up. So very excited about the space. And you just have to keep reading and keep consuming. And you know, I would advise people to, like, not everyone can build, but they can definitely try out a lot of the tools without spending a lot of the money, right? There are many ways now to experience blockchain, so that was what I would recommend.
Cool. I think we are at the end of this episode, unfortunately. Again, thanks a lot for your time, Swarup. I think the insights were really good. I personally really enjoyed this episode. I think there's a lot to learn here. Best of luck for Block Vigil and Power Loom. I think there's only one way it will go, and that's onwards and upwards. Thanks a lot again.